Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
I'm often asked how I come up with ideas for the gray area. The easy answer is I have help. It's a small team, just a couple of people, honestly, and we're constantly looking around for topics. But beyond that, I don't really have a process. I try to be as open as I can to whatever comes my way. Often it's a compelling book, but some of my favorite episodes have come from chance conversations or a Twitter thread I stumbled across. And sometimes, on the best days, I encounter something that's so exciting or profound, or something that wrestles with questions I hadn't even considered, that I know almost instantly, this has to be on the gray area. The most recent example of this is an article in the New York Times Magazine from earlier this year, called An Atheist Chaplain and a Death Row Inmate's Final Hours. The death row inmate in that headline was a man named Phil, a convicted murderer who didn't believe in God, but wanted a spiritual advisor with him as he approached his execution. And the atheist chaplain in that headline? He's today's guest. I'm Sean Illing, and this is The Gray Area. Today's guest is Devin Moss. He spent an entire year in daily conversation with a man on death row through his final moments, helping him or trying to help him navigate the end of his life on his own terms, without God or religion. Devin's also a fellow podcast host with a terrific show called The Adventures of Memento Mori. And of course, it was the whole atheist chaplain thing that got me interested. It's a compelling headline, for sure. But what really attracts me here are the deeper questions about what spiritual care looks like without religion, or why the religious instinct needs to be taken more seriously, whether you believe in God or not. Moss has spent an unusual amount of time thinking about these questions, and I wanted to talk openly with him about what he's learned. Devin Moss, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm fairly confident that you're the first atheist chaplain I've had on the show, so congrats.
Thank you. I tend to go by humanist chaplain, which is non-theist in the same way that a Buddhist is non-theist, like a Zen Buddhist in particular is non-theist. Atheist chaplain is more provocative, particularly for headlines.
I feel like atheism also has a bit of a branding problem too, so you can kind of circumnavigate that.
Yeah. Horrible branding.
How do you describe the work that you do when people ask? I mean, humanist chaplain has to be a hell of a conversation starter, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a fair amount of explaining to do, but it's also, once you kind of get to it, it's fairly easy. So it's spiritual care. And again, I don't believe in transcendence of spirit or soul. I don't think that there's a glowing part of our bodies that goes up into the sky once we die. But I do believe that there is a spirit in the sense of the third in the triumvirate of like what makes us an embodied being, right? So there's the body, the pneumatic presence, which of course a medical doctor is the one that provides care in that sense. There is the psyche, which psychologists and therapists treat that. And then I would argue that there is a third thing that connects us to each other, and it connects us to something beyond ourselves. And that is how I look at this idea of spirit. And in those moments of crisis, that too, a lot of times, that needs the most care when people are in their most vulnerable state, oftentimes the most vulnerable state that they have experienced in their lives.
How long have you been doing this kind of work?
It's been fairly recent. I kind of tripped my way into it. As a chaplain, you still have to go to seminary school. So you have to have your master's in divinity or equivalent. I did that during the pandemic. Hmm. And then we're also required to go through what's called CPE, which is clinical pastoral education. This is your clinical hours. And I did my first unit of CPE at Bellevue Hospital here in New York.
What was that like doing your residency at a hospital during a once in a generation pandemic?
It was intense. And talk about people in acute moments of crisis.
Yeah.
Bellevue Hospital in particular. And I also cannot imagine a better place to learn what it means to be spiritual. Because I came into this incredibly insecure about spirituality in general, but also what I can provide to people for as spiritual care when I'm a non-theist, right? How can I do this without God? And, you know, it was scary as hell, and it was profound as hell at the same time.
Were you a different person coming out of that?
Absolutely. And even like on a daily basis, my shift hours were from 2 to 8 or 9. And I would, at around about 1 o'clock, I'd be like, oh, I can't believe I got to go back and do this today. And then when I would leave at night, I would be like, wow, I could never imagine that would happen today. And I learned so much, and I'm a different person leaving at night than I came in the day. And that was like a repetitive cycle over and over again.
What are you doing from 2 to 8 there? I mean, are you literally going from room to room, counseling people, talking to people, spending time with them and their families? I mean, what does it look like?
Yeah. So unless someone calls specifically for a chaplain, you just do rounds and go door to door and check in on people. And so because I was afraid to pray, because I was so spiritually insecure, I'm like, you know, I'm happy to meditate with people. I've had a long meditation practice. And so I would memorize a handful of dad jokes just as something to lean on, because I do believe that humor is also medicine. And then so one of the first rooms that I went to, it was a double occupancy. So there was two guys in there. Knocked on the door, you know, and it's sort of like you had to feel out what your shtick is and how you introduce yourself. And so I knocked on the door and be like, hi, I'm Chaplain Devin, your spiritual care advisor. Is there anything that I can offer you, such as a meditation, a dad joke, prayer? And first guy says no. And then I go back to the second bed by the window and did the same thing. And he was like, no, I don't believe in God, but my mom does. And she would be very happy to know that you came and checked in on me. And so that was kind of it. And then I offered my joke du jour. And he said yes. And so I told him my joke.
I'm sorry, I can't resist. What's your best dad joke?
Well, the one I used then was, how come you never see elephants hiding in trees?
You got me.
Because they're good at it.
It's so terrible.
This is the one that introduced the groan from the bed on the other side of the room, which I take as a sign of approval. And then I mic dropped and I left the room. The next day, I went back to the same room. Both guys were there and kind of did the same thing. And then we built a rapport for about at least a week. And then I got to a point where I was looking forward to going into this room. About 10 days into it, I knocked on the door, and then his roommate, the guy closest to the door, said, hey, Mr. Johnson is looking forward to your visit today. He wants to talk to you. So I go back there and his wife is there again. He asks his wife to leave. And then he says, I realize that I haven't cried in a while. And then he follows up. He's like, and you know my mom, right? I don't know his mom, but somehow in his sort of religious background and narrative, his mom was very religious. And he mentioned his mom to me a few times. But so trust had been built in his head. I knew his mom and how important religion was to his mom. And he said, I am afraid that if I die, my mom will no longer talk to my wife and my son because of many reasons. And he wasn't afraid to die in that sense. That's not what he was expressing, but he was afraid that if he did, suddenly his wife and son and mother would no longer talk and there would be friction. And so I listened to him there, and then he started to cry. I cried with him. I talked through how he can actually begin to have those conversations and set things up practically. And that is when I learned what spiritual care was. There's a crossover between a therapist, but I wasn't there to analyze. I wasn't there to judge. I was just there to help him cry.
The reason you and I are talking right now is because I happened upon this article about your experience on death row. I guess I'm curious how you found yourself there in the first place. How does a humanist chaplain from Brooklyn end up on death row in Oklahoma?
It all begins with a Zen Buddhist named Trudy Hirsch Abramson. I was doing the podcast, and I was doing a mini-series within that about the myths of immortality, about spiritual beliefs in the afterlife. And I was just interviewing Trudy because she was sort of the subject matter expert on Buddhism. I drove up to Zen Mountain Monastery in upstate New York outside of Phoenicia, and it was as though I had known Trudy all of my life. We had a beautiful conversation, and at the end of the conversation, she says to me, you would make a good chaplain. And, you know, I sort of did a kickback reaction and was like, can't. I don't believe in God. And then her response was, I don't believe in God either. The question is, what do you believe in? That is what really started me on the journey. Okay, then what do I believe in? Because I certainly don't want to go through life identifying my belief system by what I don't believe in.
Yeah.
So it's, what do I believe in? How can I frame my life to actually index on the things that resonate and that are true to me? And in a typical Zen Buddhist voice, she just said, well, just sit on that and let it stew. And next thing you know, I went to seminary school.
And then how do you end up on death row in Oklahoma?
So soon after I finished my CPE at Bellevue, the American Humanist Association, the endorsing body, sent me an email saying that there are some attorneys that represent this man on death row named Philip Hancock in Oklahoma that are looking for a non-theist chaplain because Phil specifically wanted a non-theist chaplain. Would you be interested? And my answer was, I would absolutely be interested. And on reflection, to be candid, I felt called to do that from a spiritual care perspective, but I also was very much intrigued by the story of it. And so I wrote Phil a letter, introduced myself, and left my phone number in it and said, if you find that I am the right person to represent you or be by your side in such an important time, I would love to do so. And then we talked and we hit it off, and then we started a journey of almost a year.
What do you think he really wanted from you? Someone to listen, someone to comfort him, or just company?
All the above. I think there's a very practical, logistical element too, which is in an execution in every state by order of the Supreme Court, protected by their constitutional rights, is that the spiritual care advisor is the only one in their world, is their only ally that is allowed to be with them in the execution chamber. So he wanted an ally there with him, and one that was not there just to save his soul and pray over him. He definitely wanted someone to vent to talk with. He wanted someone to debate with and explore existentialism, just explore religion. He was incredibly smart. And so he read the Bible, but he read it to have a counter argument for it. About 4 months into it, I was getting very frustrated with the calls. We would talk every day, and it was—
Every day for 4 months?
Yeah, I mean, every day for essentially almost a year. But that month four, it started to become all-consuming for me. So he would call like at 9 in the morning, 9:30. And so that's how I would start my day. And it's a challenge then to restart your day after those conversations, right? And so it was affecting me. And this spiritual insecurity was coming up again. Like, how am I helping this guy? Am I giving him what he needed? And so I asked my mentor, my Zen Buddhist mentor, I'm like, what do I do? And Chaplain Trudy said, just ask him what he wants from you. And so I did, and he immediately quoted his interpretation of a Bible verse, which was Philippians 4, verses 7 and 8, as he interpreted it to be, show me something real, tell me something true. And that became my North Star. That was how I interpreted my role, was to find the answer to that riddle.
I'm not sure how to ask this, so I guess I'll just ask. Did you like him? I mean, I know what he's accused of. I know he claimed it was self-defense. I don't really know what happened, obviously, and it doesn't matter in this conversation. But I guess I just assume this is not someone maybe you'd normally go have a beer with, you know what I mean? But part of being a chaplain is putting all of that aside because it's not about you. But I guess that's also easier said than done.
Yeah, it was very complex. And I would also add too, is that because of the case was suspicious in the conviction. But to answer your question, I did like Phil. He was complex. I was often very frustrated by Phil as well. Sometimes I was like, I just can't answer the phone today. I just can't talk to you today, Phil. But I also think I got to know him in ways that other people weren't able to. And I think he knew it. There was other volunteers there that were compassionate, that showed up for him and were friends, but they would advocate for him no matter what. And my job wasn't to advocate. My job was to give him spiritual care. And so I didn't have to put blinders on for what he did or the potential for what he did. You know, he was many things. He was a very caring person. He did think of others a lot. And he was also a very violent person.
It was reported that he said to you at one point, you're showing me something I haven't seen from anyone. I don't recall anybody ever really coming through for me like this. And there's a lot going on there, man. In a sense, that's a beautiful thing to hear. But for me, it's also devastatingly sad because, you know, here's a guy who I imagine, like a lot of people on death row or in prison, never really had a shot. If you followed his life circumstances back far enough, you'll learn that he was probably screwed by the world and the people around him from the very beginning.
The very beginning. That's a true statement that you just made. And he made a lot of bad decisions. But you're right. Just think about that. Like, knowing that nobody in your entire life has ever showed up for you in any way. From parents expanding outward into the world. And so that also snowballs as you go through life. And then that becomes your perception. And that becomes the world. And I also think this is a good point to underscore, at least maybe deviate from this idea of Phil and I both being atheists, right? We both, by the definition of the word, atheist. But our non-belief isn't the thing that was the binding tissue of our relationship. It was humanity. His perspective of the world or of humanity is that it was inherently corrupt and vile, and humans are, when given a choice, so say we agree that when we're born, like there's no intrinsic meaning in life and we have to create that meaning for ourselves. He says humans then tend to be self-serving, violent, and essentially evil. And listen, you don't have to go far to find evidence of that. Where I came in, my perspective was yes, okay, so I am with you that there's no intrinsic meaning in life. So that means that we make the choice and we are then compelled to make the choice of being compassionate, showing up for people, doing and being better than what's best for us. That was the push and pull of like, I'm just trying to be in my own way, in our own relationship, just to be a little gravitational force for Phil to demonstrate that his perspective wasn't the only way it could have been or the way it actually was in that moment.
After a short break, we'll hear about Devin's experience on execution day. Stay with us. The Gray Area is supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research in behavioral science and dives into questions like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? And what's the power of negative thinking? The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, athletes, Nobel laureates, and more about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones. Choiceology is out now. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been podcast features. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it, didn't have the money anyway, but I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Box uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/grayarea. That's greenlight.com/grayarea to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/grayarea.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Did you have strong feelings about the death penalty before you went to Oklahoma? Did the experience change your views one way or the other?
I did not have strong opinions. I did have opinions that were, I would say, a bit mushy. And I will describe it as this. If there was a chance for anybody innocent to be executed, then I'm not for it. And yet, knowing that there are monsters among us, and I had used the same scenario that then I then heard throughout Oklahoma, this is the scenario that everybody that is pro-capital punishment will use. If it was your daughter, it's always the daughter. No one says if it were your son. If it were your daughter and she was murdered and raped, that should be the litmus test of how we think of capital punishment. That's the argument that the state legislators in Oklahoma use. And even like, I don't know where I got that, but that was kind of also in my head prior to working with Phil, is that if someone admitted to it and it was such a heinous, violent crime, then yeah, I would be okay with capital punishment. That's how I came into it. And that's okay. And those are real feelings. If a parent had to go through that horrible, horrible scenario, they have every right to feel that. And I'm not advocating that anybody can't feel those very strong and real emotions. But what I didn't realize until I was actually in the soup is that there are a lot of externalities. The ripples of who it affects, they're significant. And so if we just think that the legislators make the laws, the judicial branch of the state does the sentencing, but guess who does the executions? None of them are doing the executions. None of the family of the victims are doing the executions. It is people. It is people like me. It is people, the corrections officers in the small towns where this is more than likely the only employment opportunity they have. And we're the ones that are doing this. And I spoke with a man named Adam Luck, who was the former chair of the clemency board, the pardon and parole board before the execution. He said, everybody that has a hand in doing the execution itself, part of them dies in some way. Although that sounds like a dramatic statement.
I don't think it is.
It is absolutely 100% true. The warden isn't for it. The corrections officers aren't for it. And so with all of the externalities and all the pain, it creates a karmic ripple that is multi-lives and multi-generational.
I hope you're comfortable talking about it. But I do want to ask, because this is real life, and you were by his side when he died. And I assume the last words he heard from another person were yours. Mm-hmm. What did you say? I mean, I can imagine walking into that situation with a plan and then completely abandoning that plan in the moment because the gravity of it, because it's not what you expected.
The whole thing was surreal. The whole thing being the moments of that day and even the morning of, the governor still hadn't made a decision whether to grant clemency. The execution was scheduled for 10 a.m. So it was postponed an hour and a half. So Phil is strapped to the gurney for an extra hour plus, which is horrible to think about. The night before, they messed up his last meal. I mean, I can't even express, even to this day, like how angry that makes me. And I can't imagine, again, what it does to the spirit of someone that just cannot get any demonstration of humanity on any level. And also, sort of the last one of the frustrations is that the spiritual care advisor generally gets 45 to 30 minutes with the person that's going to be executed. Because the governor had delayed, the press corps had already made it through security. And so there's a lot of like, maintain your poise, maintain your poise, maintain your poise, because the chances of getting frazzled were high and extreme. And we went through this maze. The head chaplain then left me in this sally port where then the corrections officers escorted me up to the front door of the execution chamber. And it was there that the masked corrections officer who would be in the room with us greeted me, because the corrections officers that are in the room need to be anonymous. And then I could see in his face that he was nervous and that he was scared and that he was also affected by this moment. And then so it was kind of in that moment that I realized that part of my role is just to bring as much calmness and peace into that space as I possibly could. And that morning I had written an invocation, a prayer of sorts that I knew that needed to be said. And I did it immediately because I wanted to claim that space for Phil so that we could make it sacred and not let any time go by without making sure that he felt that this was his time.
Do you remember the prayer? It's okay if you don't, but I just want to ask.
Yeah. When I originally wrote it, I wrote it, call into the space the spirit of the divine. And then I crossed that out, and instead I just wrote, I called in the space the the spirit of our humanity, because it was very clear to me in those moments that this was a human problem and not a theological issue.
All too human.
All too human. I had the answer to the Philippians riddle, show me something real, tell me something true. I seeded that within the prayer. I wanted him to know that he was loved, and that I was a conduit to that love, and that he was not alone. And then I also invoked the spirit of grace, of strength, of surrender. And, you know, interestingly, I ended it with an amen, just because it felt right. And I also understood, too, that there were other people in that room besides Phil and I that I think needed to hear these words. And so I claimed that space for him. And then I followed it up with telling him how our relationship affected me and what it meant to me. And that he is a loved human. He died well, with grace. I also did my job well and made sure that he knew that he was loved and he was not alone. And so in this weird moment of an execution, which is weird to say, that there was peace, he transitioned well.
I really commend you for doing that. That's an awesome responsibility to be there in that way, in that moment for someone. And I just have all the respect in the world for that.
Thank you. Thank you.
I know you told the reporter from the New York Times that your thoughts to yourself as you were driving away from the prison that day were, God has nothing to do with this. And you're goddamn right about that. There's no spark of divinity in capital punishment. Pumping poison into people's veins to kill them is a thoroughly human institution. And God has nothing to do with it.
And I would also add to that, in a state like Oklahoma, who is very religious, the governor, Governor Stitt, has reclaimed the state of Oklahoma for Jesus. No matter what you believe, why would you not demonstrate the best of your faith, the best of your humanity? It just strikes me as so anti-religious under the brand, under the flag of religion. And I can't square that. And we'll never be able to.
After one more short break, Devin and I talk about whether we need religion or something like religion. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Once upon a time in America, there was no such thing as all-you-can-eat shrimp. And then the world changed.
Today, shrimp is the most popular, the most consumed seafood in America.
the endless shrimp fiesta is an American institution.
But that shrimp fiesta comes at a steep price. Here at Gastropod, we found out that hidden behind the delicious shrimp on your plate is environmental disaster and modern-day slavery.
So can you have your shrimp and a clear conscience too? Actually, yes, and we've got the secret to help you unlock true, lifelong shrimp happiness. Listen to the latest episode of Gastropod wherever you get your podcasts.
Were you raised very religious?
I was quite religious, and I would even say fanatical. So I was born in Idaho. When I was about 5, we joined an Assemblies of God church, which is Pentecostal.
That's hardcore. That's like snakes and tongues, right?
Yeah. And this is during the 1980s when they thought the rapture was imminent too. There's like a rapture cycle with the Pentecostals. You know, as a 5-year-old, every time I would see a cloud formation with a big hole in the middle, I'd be like, oh, today's the day. I'm not ready.
When did you realize, I think I'm an atheist or a humanist or whatever language you used at the time?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was always skeptical, or at least I was always curious. You know, one of the Sunday school stories that I remember being just very head-scratching to me was the story of Jonah and the whale. And the way we were taught at the time, too, it was very literal. Any metaphor, symbology, or underlying message was completely skipped over for the literal version of the story. And so I just remember raising my hand being like, so wait, so he lived in the belly of the whale? Like, how is that possible? And of course, the answer is always miracle. And so it always kind of left my eyes squinting, being like, that, I don't know about that. And then when my parents divorced when I was 11, we stopped going to church altogether. It was very extreme to nothing at all. And so I always had a little bit of a spiritual search in me, right? I always liked the idea, or like want to believe, that there is something bigger beyond our humanhood. And I became Catholic for a short bit until that same skepticism was like, then I tried Southern Baptist. And once I was through with that, I think I stopped looking. And in my family too, saying atheist was a wicked word. It was tantamount to Satanist. It was, you sacrifice puppies at night as an atheist. And so it was something that you couldn't ever say that you were that. And so you just kind of say agnostic, shrug your shoulders, and just not talk about it. And so that was kind of me through my 20s and essentially the majority of my 30s. I just, if anybody wanted to ask, I would say agnostic. And it wasn't until I started exploring how death affects life that I began to really understand how that influenced my spirituality.
Part of what interests me about your story, this story, and what you do is this question about whether we need religion or something like religion. I mean, the fact that you felt called to do the work that you do speaks to this. I mean, do you feel like there's a God-shaped hole in the modern world that needs to be filled by something, even if that something isn't supernaturalism or religion in the conventional sense?
I do believe that. I do believe that there is a God-shaped hole in all of us. And I do not feel compelled that it needs to be filled with dogma. The question that I get asked a lot in this regard too is like, and then how do you prepare someone who's dying who doesn't believe that there's something next? The answer is in the reframing of the question, is that if there is, and if that's what you believe, fine. And if we are wrong, then great. But what's more important is everything that you're doing before that moment. It is in that moment that's the most important, not after. What happens after is after. It's in that transition that is important. And how you get there is micro steps tracing back throughout your life. And so Do we need spirituality as a as an individual? Yes. And I would also say as a culture, there is a, whether it's collective consciousness or a resonance that connects us to each other and connects us out to something bigger. And I think we need to make sure that those connecting points are connected.
I've really come to be annoyed with a certain kind of atheist that can only approach religion as a set of epistemological claims, as though, you know, scanning the Bible for bogus claims about biology or history will amount to some kind of death blow for religion. And I understand where that comes from. I mean, this has always been tricky for me because I do think religion has done immense damage in the world. I think it has caused a lot of needless suffering in the world. I think it still causes a lot of needless suffering in the world. I mean, as we speak in our country, there are people who want to create a theocracy here, who want to chain women to their reproductive cycles because of their religious beliefs. And those people are enemies of liberal democracy, in my opinion. And yet also, religion, at its best, is a near universal expression of this human need for connection and meaning.
Yeah, I see spirituality and theology as two completely different animals.
Yeah.
And the way I think about religion is it is as an expression of the spiritualities. Because the way it works now is that spirituality is an expression of religion. I say flip it. I am a huge proponent on rites of passage rituals. I'm a huge proponent of even making rituals throughout your day. And you can develop for yourself. You can be as syncretic as you need to be just to make sure that it is bringing intention to attention throughout your day. And so the expression of spirituality can be your lived religion, and we can get, as sort of a cohort community, we can get enough semblance of commonality of what that looks like. Even if it's like Sunday mornings, we're going to sweep up the sidewalks in Brooklyn and have coffee and cake. That is an important spiritual expression and can be considered religion without the pomp and the history and all of those things, as you pointed out, Sean, that have proved over the centuries time and time again to be more harmful than good.
Yeah, and I just don't think truth is the primary concern of most human beings, not when you really drill down. I think that we are storytelling creatures before we are rational creatures, and the stories that organize and shape our lives do not have such power over us because they are empirically true. They're powerful because of the effects of believing in them and the solace they provide, the connection they provide, the meaning they provide. That is real and true, even if the beliefs themselves aren't. And I guess that kind of sounds like apologetics for faith, and maybe it is in some way, but I still think it's right. And I suspect maybe you do too. Or
I do. I think it's important that we understand mythology and our predilection for stories and understand that they are stories, but they are guiding stories as well. And so I'm with you. It's not a position that is also an absolute, in my opinion. I think you need to hold the steering wheel fairly loosely. And I am a firm believer in the scientific method. I love reason. Definitely love proof in the right circumstances and in the right arguments. And I think there is a understanding in a time when we're sort of crossing the ontologies, right? We're crossing the ways of the areas. I equally get annoyed when New Age spirituality folks bring in physics.
Yeah, me too. Can't stand it.
Stop crossing the streams. These are two different modes of thinking. Both are equally important, but we need to understand when we're in them, which one we're operating in. And spirituality also is not something that's inherited. And part of it is that it must be a journey. It is provisional. the more you learn, the more you feel, the more then it develops.
I heard you mention in one of your podcasts that people who really have faith die better. It's not hard to understand why that may be the case, you know, the comfort that must come with the belief in the afterlife or something like that. It may not be an equivalent solace, but what kind of solace can a more humanistic worldview offer to someone as they approach the end?
Death is hard for everybody. And it is hard because we avoid it personally, and we most definitely avoid it as a culture. How a culture dies is a direct reflection of how they live. And we do not die well in modern America. And so I would probably take out the border of faith and non-faith when it comes to how to die well. I would just say that dying well requires work that is to be done while you're still very much alive, with or without a faith in a supernatural power.
I've always hated that line of, you know, there are no atheists in foxholes. I get the point. And I guess there's some truth in that. But also, there are actually atheists in foxholes, and there are countless examples of people who hold fast to their principles when facing death, you know, who don't sacrifice their intellectual integrity out of fear at the end.
And what sort of God puts you in a foxhole trying to avoid bullets and being killed by somebody else anyway?
Yeah.
Like, what? Who's in a foxhole that says this is the divine will?
Yeah.
I think there's plenty of atheists, and there's far too many foxholes.
You know, I heard you ask in one of your podcasts, like, what would it mean to live as though we're not entitled to time? I think most of us, myself included, do live as though we have infinite time, and we'll probably regret that at the end. But I don't know what it would mean if we always lived as though the lights could go out in 10 minutes. You know, that's hard to do, you know?
It's so hard to do, and it's a muscle that we have to exercise. And that's what I think this idea of a lived religion that's an expression of your spirituality comes in. And even if it's a recognition when you first wake up in the morning, even if it's a meditation you do before you go to bed, we would not be advanced as we were if all we did all day was live in the now and not see ourselves 20 years from now. Sheldon Solomon says it so well. He's a sociology professor that has proved out Ernest Becker's denial of death and how it affects us psychologically. The way he says it is that we just need to face it long enough where it can break our involuntary belief systems.
Our last episode was about Ernest Becker's the denial of death. I don't know if I'm going through some kind of midlife crisis and I'm working the shit out here on the show. It just kind of went down this way. I don't know. What do you think happens when we die, Devin? I assume you must have thought about that, being around death so much.
Yeah, my answer's simple. We die. It goes just as black as it did before we were born. And then I twist the question to be like, what's important is what happens while we live. Why do we need an afterlife? Well, it's so it can manage the terror of there being nothing, which is terrifying. Why do we need a transcendent soul when the raccoon in my backyard isn't worthy of one? It makes us different because we realize we are conscious and someday we'll be unconscious.
Death is something we all do alone, but dying doesn't have to be a solo activity. And I'm glad there are people who do what you do, who make sure that people don't have to die alone.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Devin Moss is a chaplain and host of the podcast, The Adventures of Memento Mori. Damn, this was a pretty heavy one. But it was personal and raw, and I really did get a lot out of it. And yeah, I don't know what to say other than I hope it was valuable to you. And if you have any thoughts about any of it, things I should have said or did say or you wish I said, drop me a line at thegrayarea@vox.com and tell me. I read all the emails, I promise. This episode was produced by John Ahrens, edited by Jorge Just, engineered by Patrick Boyd, and Alex Obrington wrote our theme music. New episodes of The Gray Area drop on Mondays. Listen and subscribe. The Gray Area is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep Vox free by going to vox.com/give.